Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch, episode 132 for August 25th, 2010, the Evergreen Library System. It's time for Floss Weekly, the weekly show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, here bringing you the biggest, the brightest, the best, all the interesting people that I can manage to line up in a particular time slot, this nice Wednesday morning time slot that we taped this at. And we have, again, a really special show up for you today. But first, let me bring on my co-host, Dan Lynch. Hello, Dan.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well, going well. And you're over in the UK somewhere, I presume, as usual?
Yeah, I'm just on the outskirts of Liverpool in the UK. We haven't quite got the weather that you've got in LA, I'm afraid. But, you know, we have other things going for us, I'd like to think, anyway.
Yeah, when I got up this morning to walk across the street from the hotel over to the place where I'm working here at Oversea.net, I'm up here on the 43rd floor of the ninth tallest building in L.A., and it was already 78 degrees. Now, that's Fahrenheit, not Celsius. That would be really hot if it was Celsius. but it's just really, really, really been warm here. Let's see. So we have a last week we talked about how you do a news show. You do your Linux Outlaws show. And you said that it was really all handled because Fab, you had the studious German to really take care of most of your work.
And yeah, so, well, it's certainly the news, yeah. He looks after the news.
Yeah, and so I actually said, well, I need one of those. Well, I had a bunch of people actually apply, so thank you all
for
applying.
Excellent.
I got to be careful what I ask for here. How about $1 million? Anybody have $1 million that they just want to spare? That would be handy, too. Okay, so just kidding on that as well. So this week, we actually have a couple of really interesting guests. We have another Dan Scott, who works for Coffee Code, which is a company that provides support, and Mike Rylander, who also works for a company providing support for Evergreen Library System. The Evergreen Library System is something that, you know, not sexy, not glorious, but, you know, when you go to the library and you check something out, something has to keep track of all that. And so there's this, they have this great open source system around for a few years, managing how to do that. I think we're going to have to speak in hushed tones, though, right, Dan? Because these are librarians, right?
That's true.
I think they're going to go shh to us a little bit, or I don't know. That's it'll be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe they'll get catches for our late fees, fees that we haven't paid.
Yeah. I don't want to have that happen. So we'll just we'll have to be careful not to mention those books that I borrowed and haven't returned yet. All right. Well, anyway, so any other opening remarks before we get on to our guests?
No. I think libraries and open source are a particularly good match, I suppose, because it's all about sharing information, isn't it? And collaborating and making stuff easier to swap and share and stuff. So I'm intrigued to hear what they've got to say.
So let's go ahead and bring our guests online here. We've got Dan Scott with us. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Randall.
And where am I speaking to you from?
Today I'm in the office of the university librarian at University of Prince Edward Island.
Well, that's nowhere near Georgia.
Normally, you'd find me up in Sudbury, Ontario at Laurentian University.
Okay, but you're working with the project even though you're nowhere near Georgia where it all started then.
Absolutely.
Very cool. Very cool. So I gave a bit of a description about what Evergreen really is all about at the beginning, but maybe you could give us sort of the more elaborate, you know, 30-second elevator pitch for it. What's Evergreen all about?
Sure. It's a little bit difficult to describe to people who aren't librarians, but it's called an integrated library system. And the idea is that it kind of gives you cradle-to-grave management of your library's materials. So things like information about borrowers, things about like acquiring materials, providing rules for loans, whether material can be loaned or not, where that material is, whether there are fines associated with not bringing them back, sending notifications to patrons. It's still a fairly core piece of infrastructure for libraries all around the world today. Anybody who has anything electronic going on in their library probably has some sort of integrated library system in the mix.
Okay, very good. And also joining us today is Mike Rylander. Hello, Mike.
Hello, how are you doing, sir?
Doing well, doing well. And where are we speaking to you from?
I'm actually on site at a a library that will be going on to Evergreen within the next month or so, working on final preparations.
Very cool. Very cool. So for those kids who haven't been to libraries, because I know there's probably quite a few now, yeah. Let's back up just a little bit. So the main problem with managing libraries, you have thousands of things that need to be kept track of, and you have people that come in and check these things out for periods of time. So why would you need anything more than an Excel spreadsheet to manage all this?
Well, to give you a practical example, the libraries in Georgia, the ones that that first funded and helped design and build Evergreen, they have 10 million items on 2 million bibliographic records across just under 300 locations. So an Excel spreadsheet or an Access database generally isn't going to cut it.
So one of the aspects of this, which I think you just alluded to there, was that we actually talk about sharing the information or sharing the materials across multiple sites. So I could go into my nearest library and say, I want this book, but you don't have it, but somebody else in the system does.
Right, exactly. Now, originally, the ILS is, I think I heard Dan giving a definition when I dropped in. ILSs were designed for a single site or a small set of libraries, just a few branches. Of a couple decades, they grew in capability to be able to share resources among tens of libraries, but they're all still politically one unit. And something that Evergreen does is it allows you to share resources between politically
I think we're losing Mike there. So, Dan, you want to finish the question? Can you?
Sure. Sure, I'll step in. So one of the things that Evergreen does is it enables you to share data and materials across politically separate sets of libraries.
Okay.
You can still maintain the same system. So a lot of the cost of integrated library systems for libraries are the people who are the technical experts in keeping it running, extending and maintaining it, customizing it, those sorts of positions. Those are expensive people to have, as I'm sure you are both aware. Mm-hmm. So having a shared system helps library systems save some costs on that front, at the same time as gaining the advantages of being able to share some of the data back and forth.
Now, what's the history of this? Why did this come about? And I actually read some of the story, and I was sort of surprised that some of the proprietary systems actually didn't even cut the bait on this one. So can you tell me what the history is and why it exists?
Sure. The state of Georgia, Georgia Public Library Service, ran into a situation, I think in 2003, 2004, where the scale of the number of libraries that they were working with and the scale of the materials and the transactions, the system that they had at the time that they had adopted for the Y2K crisis simply wasn't able to handle the scale of transactions. And to update the new system 3 or 4 years later, they were looking at that time, the system really only ran on Solaris hardware. So they were looking at something like $2 million in hardware alone just to scale up. So one of the librarians, Brad Lajeunesse, who's I think now the president of Equinox Library Systems, Equinox Software Incorporated, a company that provides Evergreen support, made the business case that rather than spending $2 million on hardware, which would just need to be replaced in another couple of years down the road, they should instead invest that money in programming time to develop an open source library system from scratch built on modern architectural principles, rather than sort of a foundation that had been built about 20 years ago and had just been slowly updated since then.
Interesting. So rather than committing to hardware that's going to be obsolescent real quickly, now why was the decision made to go open source? Is it just because librarians are naturally sharing, or was there some politics to that?
There is certainly an element of it that librarians are naturally sharing. Part of it was also to ensure that that the libraries would never be in a situation of being sort of at the mercy of a particular vendor. I mean, the problem that they had at that time was they had one vendor who is suggesting one set of hardware, and the costs to move from one library system to another are still incredible. In comparison to being able to invest all that money back into materials and new services that libraries can offer, buildings even. So the investment there was, we value intellectual property and the development of new creative ways of accomplishing problems and adopting modern technology over sinking it into hardware that's going to be outdated and still having the same problems in terms of difficult to extend software and proprietary lock-in that that they saw. They also saw an opportunity for other libraries to join in and contribute to the system. So their time frame for going live in 2004, when they decided to take a tackle this project, was to go live in 2006. So they had a 2-year window to develop a system from scratch. They knew there were going to be parts of the system that weren't complete, that they were hoping others would be able to help fill in. And so they did go live September 1st, 2006, with Evergreen, the first version of it.
Now, what does this encompass in terms of scope? Is there public-facing parts of this? I mean, is there parts like a website that I go online and see if my local library has a particular item? There's probably like an inventory control interface of some kind, and maybe a sharing request interface of some kind. What are the parts? What are the components to this?
Yeah, it breaks down into, I guess, two major parts that are visible to human beings. The public view would be the catalog, the place where you search for the availability of items. Say, find out that an item might not be available, but you want to get a hold of it, so you therefore can place a hold on and request it to be added. And I see my screen is fading out and I'm about to get locked out. Ah, sorry. There we go.
One of those oddly warnings.
Oddly enough, it's a great, unable to block that screensaver. Anyways, there's the front end, which it provides search and discovery and the ability to ask for an item to be shipped to your library or to be placed in a queue to get a hold of the item. So, you know, when the latest Girl with a Dragon Tattoo novel comes out, not that there'll be any more, sadly, you can get in line to get the last copy of it once it's available at your library. So that's the front end broadly. And then the back end is, as you said, the inventory control piece. And that piece is built on the Zool framework, Mozilla Zool framework. And that's where staff manage things like patron information or descriptions of the items that are available or setting up rules in the system, that side of the human experience.
Now, I was curious about the hardware and stuff that you would need to kind of implement a system like this. So what kind of software and hardware do you need to run Evergreen on top of?
So we made the choice. I joined the project in 2006, early 2007. So I didn't make the choice. I just accepted it and embraced it. The choice was made to run on Linux. And the initial rollout was on Debian Linux. And this is x86 commodity hardware. So the cost comparison at the time, Georgia Pines is the name of the consortium that went live with this, with 169 libraries, I think. The cost comparison at the time was they had a ridiculous rack of servers. The architecture for Evergreen is built on something called OpenSurf, the Open Service Request Framework. The idea of OpenSurf is that it's a distributed set of services where you can add another server to the system to address any choke points in the system, and it just starts contributing its power to the overall whole. So they had a ridiculous rack of servers, commodity x86 servers, something along the lines of $400,000 worth of hardware, I think they cut it down to. I could be wrong. I hope that Michael will be able to jump in and correct me on that. So I can talk about our library system. I work for Laurentian University, and we're part of a consortium of Ontario academic and special libraries called Project Conifer. And we have a total of about 5 servers running our Evergreen instance that's shared amongst 3 universities, a medical school, and a number of special libraries, 2 colleges as well. And the biggest piece of hardware there is for the PostgreSQL database that's in the back end. We have a significantly beefy piece of hardware with 48 gigabytes of RAM for that one, because that's where the choke point is when we're doing searches. Of course, you can replicate the database and distribute out searches to the replicated databases, but we're trying to keep things a little bit simple in our case. The other four servers are very basic, sort of off-the-shelf commodity servers these days.
Yeah, so you mentioned that it originally ran on Debian Linux, and you can still install it on Debian Linux. I had a look on your website, and it says you can install this on Red Hat or SUSE or lots of other distributions. So that's a lot of packages and things to maintain. Who takes care of that? Do the distributions look after that kind of thing, or do you guys have to package things up, you know, for certain distributions?
Packaging is one of the areas where we still have a weak point. We moved to AutoTools, so AutoConf and AutoMake, about 2 years ago. Actually, a student that was working with me at the time worked for Equinox software to add that capability. But we rely mostly on system packages for as many of the dependencies as possible. However, there are still the core part of Evergreen is still a tarball that you download, do the configure, make install dance, run from there. We would love to have people who have packaging skills jump in and help us out with that piece.
Okay, so there's not say a Debian repository or something that you can just, you know, do apt-get install Evergreen, which would be lovely, and just install it all. Unfortunately, it's not always that easy.
Yeah, unfortunately, we'd love to have that, but one of our principles is that we haven't invested a huge amount of time on the install side of things because we want to flesh out the functionality, and in, none of the people on the project at this point have real packaging. Packaging isn't in our background, so we'd need to invest time in ramping up to learn packaging rather than contributing new functionality or enhancements or bug fixes. So we're hoping that someone might come along who just helps solve that problem for us.
Yeah, that would be nice. So what kind of languages and other things, dependencies do you have that you would need to get up and running before you could install Evergreen then?
So Evergreen runs on the OpenSurf architecture. Is actually an XMPP JSON over XMPP architecture. So we run the eJabberD server for XMPP, and that's packaged thankfully by almost everybody. The main language that Evergreen is developed in is Perl. So I don't know, yay. Randall, you might be familiar with that.
Yay.
I think I learned Perl from one of your books to begin with. So
it's a lot of people have. Yeah.
We also optimize some parts of the server in C, which is important, obviously, for avoiding bottlenecks. There's a good bit of JavaScript in there, and we take advantage of the Dojo framework, which is maybe a little bit of an odd choice these days, but I think Peter Higgins, your guest a number of shows ago, did a good job of explaining what the Dojo toolkit was all about. And it provides a lot of the front-end support these days for both the end-user interface and the staff interfaces. So those are probably the main strengths that you would need in terms of development, one or all of those languages.
Right. And you mentioned earlier that your client's based on ZoolRunner, which is the Mozilla technology. And obviously you have different aspects to this program. So you've got a client, a client facing aspect and then the rest of it. So if you come to install the client on different machines, say different platforms, one of the great things about Zool, you can install it on different platforms. What would you need to do? Does all the Zool stuff come packaged, or do I have to kind of install Firefox first and then install the client, or what happens with all that?
We provide packages for Windows, a prepackaged version of the client for Windows, since that's where most of the libraries still run their staff clients. On other platforms such as Linux or Mac, there is one library that's providing prepackaged Macintosh staff clients. On Linux, it's a pretty straightforward matter of just pointing ZoolRunner at at the appropriate directory and telling it to go. And we perhaps incorrectly make the assumption that if you're running on Linux, you'll be able to make that happen without too much of a problem.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So something else I was a bit curious about was the whole licensing of this. It's licensed under the GPL. Now, I know you weren't one of the original creators of the project, but do you have any insight into why they chose the GPL specifically as opposed to something like a BSD license or an Apache license, something more permissive, if you like?
I think there was two reasons for that. One was the GPL was perhaps the more predominant license at the time in 2004 when the project really got underway and some of the code started being contributed. It is the GPL v2 or later license, so it does leave us with the option of upgrading to GPL v3 at some point if we so desire without too much of a hassle. I think part of the choice was to make a statement that we want this to be a shared system as much as possible. So while we welcome people to contribute to it, and certainly we'd be happy to see the legacy providers, say, adopt it and use it. We want to make sure that contributions continue to come in to the project. So I think that was part of it as well, a philosophical approach.
Now, one of the interesting things about an open source project is that there are often a user community that really doesn't contribute back to the project, but contributes essentially support costs because, you know, they ask questions. And then you have actual people that are actually delving into the code and contributing back. Well, how would you say the ratio of your project is between those two communities?
We've had a number of people who are who contribute patches over time. Some people drop into the community. They want to run Evergreen just for their home family library, which is...
Really?
It's incredible. I mean, in comparison to the 169 libraries that Georgia Pine started out with, yeah, somebody has just cataloged their family's library, and they've got like 3,000 items. But yeah, they'll find a problem in some area, and they've contributed patches. But I'd say by far the majority of our contributors are on the mailing list support side. And it's an interesting side note is that when we used to run a legacy library system, most of our support actually came from the user community, even with the proprietary system. And so the arguments about, oh, well, you know, going open source, you won't have a good support vendor behind the system, never really flew with me anyways. So, So we do have a really strong community on the mailing list and IRC support side of things.
Well, wait, you're saying even if you go closed source, you don't have good support? Come on. So yeah, great. That was just an off comment there. So I was thinking about your comment a moment ago. I had a couple of friends that. And we all have these big DVD collections back when I was actually, you know, buying DVDs instead of just renting it online and watching it online. But so we always think about, well, we need some sort of system that kind of like say, well, here's my 700 DVDs and here's your 500 DVDs. And there's a little bit of an overlap and we'd like to borrow back and forth. So Evergreen would even be useful in a small situation like that?
It's probably overkill for a situation like that. There's a lot of assumptions about library practices built into Evergreen. Okay. So to keep libraries happy and to say, I'll say this up front, I am a librarian, have my degree, et cetera. Not just a geek. I'm a library geek, which is a very special kind of geek. Yeah. There are standards that you must follow if you want to be a player, at least in the current library system market. So there's an encoding standard called MARC, which is machine readable cataloging, which dates back to 40 years ago that still sets the bar for what must be done. And unfortunately, it means that most of these systems are, they require a specialized knowledge that most people wouldn't want to have to start with. It's incredibly powerful once you do have that knowledge. But it's a barrier to entry. There are some areas where, with the newer version of Evergreen, we're trying to make it require less of that specialized knowledge. So perhaps as time goes on, it'll be more generalized, but it would probably be overkill for that sort of situation.
Cool. And while we have Mike back on the line, Mike, how does Equinox fit into all of this? I mean, you're a for-profit company, I presume, and you're trying to support Evergreen? And how does it all work in terms of structure and relationship?
Well, we're our hope is to milk this newfangled open source thing for everything it's worth.
yeah, of course.
No, we are a services company. So when GPLS went live, or when Pines went live on Evergreen, we started getting a lot of interest from other libraries around the country and generally in North America even. But GPLS and Pines are not in a position to provide support to other libraries. Right. So,
oh no.
All right.
I think he's gone again.
Well, that's the most answer he's given once.
I can finish off the story for him if you'd like.
Please do.
So, as GPLS and Pines weren't in the position to provide support for other libraries directly, I mean, they're not allowed to by their mandate as a public service, to encourage the adoption of more of Evergreen by more libraries. And Mike Rylander and Brad Lajeunesse and Bill Erickson and Jason Etheridge, who are the four people primarily behind Evergreen, were encouraged to offer support and services on their own to other libraries. And as a result, they were almost forced into setting up their own company and moving off to become a standalone company that offered Evergreen support and development services. So that's where Equinox got its genesis. And the GPLS people are all very understanding of how that happened, from what I understand. And they've certainly been a great asset to the Evergreen community. They've continued to contribute in the open very publicly, and that's been important. I have to admit, I was skeptical in the beginning when I saw the Evergreen project and the some of the C pieces of code started coming in, because I thought, this is going to be the trick. They're going to take Perl, optimize it into C, but the C will be licensed under some other license that will prevent it from being truly open source. But they've been 100% open source from the start and continue to be that today.
That's got to be a really interesting, a real challenge to do. I mean, obviously, there's the conflicting goals of wanting to, you know, make money being selling something. Is this open core at all? Is there like some part of it that you'd have to pay to get on top of that, or is it strictly open source from top to bottom, and you're getting money only from services?
It's open source from top to bottom. There is no extension that I'm aware of that's available only to paid people. There might be some customizations, tweaks to look and feel somewhere that might not be contributed back, but I don't think that's out of any malicious intent. That's just because that's what people have done to their website. So,
sure.
Or their interfaces. So yeah, it's a pretty unusual case. It's a case of a business that doesn't need to rely on OpenCore to succeed. Part of the reason, I think, is because library systems knowledge is a fairly niche area. So there aren't a lot of people who could even step up to compete and take over, even with an entirely open body of code, such as Evergreen has. There's still a whole lot of knowledge that you need to have to be able to master that code and make it do your bidding.
So let's say I have a library and I have 30,000 books sitting behind me here, and I'm probably using maybe some proprietary system to keep track of that for now, and I want to switch maybe to Evergreen. Is there a standard format that for how my catalog is listed that I can import it directly into this system? Is it using MARC, I guess?
MARC would be the standard format, the somewhat standard format that would be used. You'd still need to pull all sorts of other information from your system, such as the availability of the item, whether it's in somebody's hands or not at this moment.
Sure.
A lot of that sort of state information isn't available or isn't standardized. Or if it is standardized, it's not being used by most of the systems that are out there. Same sort of thing for fine information and all the other ephemeral stuff. So there's certainly a lot of openings for people with skills with particular library systems to assist with migration. So I know there are other companies like AlphaG that have done migrations from legacy systems to Evergreen, Bywater Solutions. There's a number of other companies that are in competition with Equinox, which is a great scenario for us as as libraries, running a system that not only is there a choice of people to support and develop your system, but they're competing with each other. So there's actually an incentive for them to do a really good job and answer your phone call.
So there's companies actually in parallel with Equinox also supporting this, making their money doing that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
There's at least, yeah. I have to admit that as of about a week ago or 2 weeks ago, I started my own company and I'm doing very small time consultation during my holidays to do some work. So that's what I'm at UPEI for today and for the next week or so.
Very cool. And so part of the thing that has to get into the catalog is the detailed information. Is there some sort of public interface for, like, you know, if I have this book and I'm adding it to my catalog? Excuse me for being naive about libraries, but I mean, there's got to be some meta information about this book that I have in my hands that I want to put on my shelf. Are there APIs out somewhere, like maybe the National Library of Congress or something, that lets me go off and get all the metadata about a particular item?
For sure. There's the API that's normally used is called Z3950. So you can, you know, usually you just do a search based on ISBN or the title and author, and you can search. The Library of Congress is one of the places you can search. There are a number of libraries that that make their data freely available. And there's sort of an ongoing controversy and discussion in the library community about the sharing of data. There's a library cooperative nonprofit that actually keeps its data only available to members, and it happens to be, you know, the behemoth that many libraries are pressured into joining. So it's an interesting sort of situation as well. But yes, there's certainly APIs available to pull in data, and that's how we do the bulk of our work.
And there's both factual information, like, you know, the author and pub date and publisher and things like that, but there's also probably a wealth of information about, like, reviews, editorial information about books. Is that also available to be searched in a cataloging system like Evergreen?
Yeah, we at this point, we're not doing a whole lot to pull in the review information and actually search it. We have provided a lot of third-party integration with review providers and enriched data to pull those into Evergreen and make them available to people to support their selection process. Things like Google Books integration. You talked about lots of kids haven't even been in a library. And one of my goals as a systems librarian is to enable our faculty to not have to step into the library as much as possible. So making electronic books easily available through a single interface rather than having to go off and search 19 different databases of content to find the electronic book they're looking for is one of our goals as well. So right now, most of this information is displayed at display time. Licensing can sometimes be an issue. You know, you can't just take Amazon's reviews and stuff them into your system and use them for your own, although I think lots of places might do that. We've provided some integration at that level.
It'd be interesting, I don't know if it's possible or if it's already being done, to have like an Amazon buy this now link so that the library would actually make money by selling the book to you through Amazon.
There are certainly sites that do that. There are sites that are very anti-commercial and see that as being against their mandate. But I know sites that do provide Amazon Buy It Now links for those people who can't wait to get a copy in their library, don't want to be, you know, in a queue to wait for, you know, being fourth down the list, or don't want to wait for their own library just to buy a copy on demand for them. That's what a lot of libraries do, is they say, well, rather than going off and buying a copy yourself, just let us know that you want a copy and we'll buy it for you.
Yeah, I was curious about something called the Evergreen Effect, which I read about on your website. So what is the Evergreen Effect then?
Ah, you must have been reading the Evergreen blog.
I believe, yeah. I've done research. My research for once.
I'm impressed. This is not how Linux Outlaws happens. I am a huge fan of Linux Outlaws, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's not true. You guys do your research sometimes.
Sometimes.
The Evergreen Effect. So when Georgia Pines went live, I believe they saw a year-over-year massive increase in the amount of materials that were shared between libraries. Part of that had to do with a much more rational scheme for making copies of items available to people who are requesting them. The previous system had a bizarre algorithm that would just always try and take, I think, the last copy that was had been added to the system. So there was a new library that had been added to their system that they were on the verge of hiring a full-time person just to keep the items that were in transit to other libraries in the system going with the old system. The new system actually shares it in a much more geographically aware way. It understands zip codes and geographic information, so it will try and get a copy from the nearest location to you geographically if you provide it with that information, rather than shipping it from one end of the state to another end of the state or across the country or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. It must save a lot in resources as well, because you obviously, as you say, you don't want to go shipping a book from one side of the country to another if there's a copy around the corner and you don't know about it.
Right, right. I mean, that way they can spend more money on getting a broader range of items rather than, you know, getting 50 copies of the latest Harry Potter novel and then shipping, you know, 40 copies off to the shredder after the initial hype is over.
You're not a Harry Potter fan then, I take it, from that. Anyway, so I was wondering about, there are other open source library systems out there, notably things like, hang on a second, I've forgotten the name of it. Things. This is where my research falls down. Is it Koha? I don't know how you pronounce it. K-O-H-A, I think it is. I think it's Koha. Yeah. Is one of the options. So yeah, how do you compare yourselves to that then?
Well, Koha dates back actually to a Y2K project, and it was started in New Zealand to replace a system that was not Y2K compliant, and done in an incredibly short period of time. Also written in Perl, so yay there.
Yay.
They have, I guess, over 10 years of history now in existence of the project. They've got an extremely thriving community. They have translations into many dozens of languages, if not, you know, if not 100 languages. And they're an interesting system in that, in comparison to Evergreen, in that they started out as a very much a one library sort of small system that it didn't try to do MARC to begin with. It tried to do things a new way. And then later on, MARC support was added to it to make librarians happier. And it started to grow up. And so when we in Project Conifer started looking at moving to a new library system, we had considered Koha, but at the time, its scalability was still limited by its dependence on MySQL. And MySQL had a... it would basically fall over at the time, at least the openly available version of it would fall over at around 500,000 rows in a given table. So there is a scalability issue there that we were blowing past already with our own system. We're at 1 million items or something. So we gave it a miss and went directly to Evergreen because it had a proven set of scalability. Since then, Koha has really done a lot of work on their scalability improvement. I'm not sure where they're at now, but they are a very viable and thriving project. And we share a lot of... a lot of dependencies, a lot of the base libraries that we rely on, we work on with the Koha people. And in fact, Equinox also offers Koha support now, and they employ two of the primary Koha contributors. So there's a real cross-fertilization of the projects, which is really healthy and really important. Because, as I said, we're a niche area. We need all the people we can get contributing to make things better.
So you keep talking about Perl. So I have to keep asking these questions. My Perl friends would just be really angry if I didn't ask all this. So is the primary UI web-based then? Are you talking to Apache behind the scenes then?
We are talking to Apache behind the scenes. We're using a little bit of template toolkit in some areas. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty rocking. It took me a while to learn it, but now that I've got the hang of it, the only thing I really need help on is doing a better job of providing internationalization support in it, because that was turning my head around. But if somebody wants to give me a hand with that, I'd be happy. I made a really crappy run at it in my own interfaces, but I'd like to do a better job.
Do you have any framework you're using above that, like maybe Catalyst or something?
Actually, no. That's about it. So on top of that, I guess... Or apart from Template Toolkit, we are also using Apache, a lot of server-side includes, a lot of XML with server-side includes. It's and a lot of JavaScript, Ajax kind of approach. In fact, one of my peers, Art Rhino, has called the Evergreen public interface a testimony to the scalability of Ajax, or which is in some ways, I think, a backhanded compliment because it's, at some point you'd really just want to see some plain HTML behind the scenes, and the HTML that's there is mostly there to satisfy the demands of the JavaScript. And so I think over time that's going to be something that'll change as well for the purposes of mobile interfaces. I believe there's a library system, BC Sitka, out in British Columbia. They were actually the second library system to adopt Evergreen, who have developed a mobile OPAC that they're in the plans of contributing that back to the community. Sorry, mobile web interface that they're contributing back. And I think that might be an interesting base to build on for a more plain HTML approach with a little bit less reliance on JavaScript for some of the core pieces.
And I heard you mention Postgres earlier. Yay for Postgres. It's a real database people need to use. Do you have an ORM layer at all in between Perl and Postgres?
Yeah, it's actually a custom ORM layer. So yeah, there's been it's taken a while for me to wrap my head around it. Mike, unfortunately, whose connection isn't staying alive for us, was kind of the genius behind that. And it does a really great job of translating objects into a relational layer. It uses its own sort of pseudo SQL, but it uses JSON as the language for making queries and providing updates. It's really nice though because it does instantiate objects across Perl and across JavaScript and Python. We have support for. We had Java support for a while, but then nobody wanted to write any Java, so it's sort of fallen to the wayside. And C, you can easily access it in C. And that's called the Field Mapper ORM. So, yeah, as much as it'd be nice to be living in a world where there's, you know, say a book about the ORM, there is some good documentation about it that has been contributed that I rely on religiously.
Do you provide any sort of public-facing APIs? So I, for example, write my own thing that goes out and sees if my favorite books have finally come in or something?
Yeah, actually, there's a ton of APIs that are available. That was one of the goals from the start, and that's what the JavaScript interfaces rely on heavily. So there's a lot of web APIs. It's sort of an XML RPC or JSON RPC approach. Mm-hmm. You can query those publicly through a there's an interface that generates via XSLT magic a list of all of the methods and all the arguments that are required and all the descriptions of all the methods that are available for all of the various services. So I should step back a bit and say in OpenSurf, methods are aggregated into services, and those services are what you can run on one or more servers across your cluster of servers if you're facing a scalability issue. So each one of those can publish the methods that it offers. And there's varying amounts of documentation in terms of how much, how many permissions might be required for the user. But yeah, you can absolutely do a lot of automated querying and scraping, querying via the APIs if you want.
So I could, for example, on my blog page, I could have here are the three most recent books I've read from my local library and help promote the library that way.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the new pieces of functionality that's coming out in 2.0. In previous versions of Evergreen, you could maintain your own book bags and publish those via RSS or Atom feeds publicly, and you could then pull them in and provide links to the information that way. Or if it's Atom, then you could obviously wrap it and turn it into whatever sort of output you wanted. In 2.0, I believe there's been a new piece of functionality built to create reading lists. So you have the option of creating and maintaining a reading list that'll automatically track what you've what you've kept. And I believe you can publish that, make that publicly available. So kind of the opposite of the privacy paranoia that we see with some things, some other services. We give you the option of publishing that and making that live. Obviously, there are some things you might not want to publish on your reading list. And I believe you've got the ability of hiding certain items.
Do you have any way of doing things like, well, I read these five books, and people who read those five books probably also want to read this other sixth book? Do you have that kind of analysis software behind the scenes?
Yeah, we haven't done the Netflix style matching recommendation engine at this point. That would be a great piece to pull in, and it's pretty cool that there are some algorithms that are publicly available for that purpose. But yeah, we haven't done that as of yet. Certainly in the academic sphere, which is sort of my area of interest, that would be really useful for research purposes.
Cool. And actually, I guess that'd be sort of a call to action. If somebody out there has got time and expertise with stuff like this, I'm sure you'd welcome their contributions to the project then.
Oh, yeah. We try to be as welcoming as possible. Easiest way to get a hold of us is on the IRC channel. We're on Freenode at the Pound Evergreen channel. And the mailing list is pretty active and supportive as well. And we're motivated to get other people join in with us and join forces.
So how much of what happens, you know, in a library does this system encompass? Is it doing most of what people want already? Is it still just a little piece of it? Or is it like, how much more demand is there to keep making this bigger and better, cooler, other than things like this recommendation engine?
Well, so as of, I think 2 days ago, Mike and I were wrapping up the corresponding releases of OpenSurf and Evergreen to provide support for Evergreen 2.0 and Alpha release. So as of Evergreen 2.0, we're going to have things like, this will mean more to librarians, unfortunately, but things like acquisitions, so the purchasing system and invoicing, et cetera, with EDI support. So if you've worked with EDI, you know what it is. It's painful, but there's a lot of support that's been added there. Support for managing all of the issues of all of the journals that you have in the library. This is called serial support for librarians. A real stab at that is in place for 2.0. A lot of the core functionality that a library needs is in place as of the 2.0 release. A lot of my effort now, and the reason I'm at UPI, for example, is more to focus on smoothing out some of the user interface pieces and removing some of the annoyances rather than whole cloth creation of new functionality. I was doing a little bit of work for the International Institute of Social History in Amsterdam, which is a really nice place to work, on authority work, which is maintaining the official names, say, of authors and remembering making it consistent, their, say, birth and death dates to identify who wrote something. This is extremely important to librarians, and it was functionality that was present but in a very limited way in previous versions. As of 2.0, it's going to be perhaps one of the only library systems that implements it according to the specification, which is pretty exciting.
Now, lately we've heard a lot about the website WikiLeaks on the news and their exploits, if you like. There's actually a kind of link between WikiLeaks and Evergreen, isn't there? So can you elaborate on that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I don't, for fear of possibly stepping into libelous territory, I don't want to delve too deeply into it, but back in October of 2009, there was a white paper published on WikiLeaks that most of us hadn't heard of, but when we did hear about it, our eyes opened very wide. The white paper was published by a proprietary library system vendor called Circe Dynex. And it was written by the vice president of innovation and the chief strategist, both of whom were the same person at this company. And it was called Integrated Library System Platforms on Open Source. So this white paper was being distributed to customers, and the subtitle was Caveat Emptor. And so this white paper was essentially a marketing document spreading fear, uncertainty, and doubt about open source library systems like Evergreen and Koa, and trying to sow as much, concern about adopting the system, as much information about adopting the system as they plausibly could. So when this paper appeared on WikiLeaks, it gave us a boost because obviously this vendor was very concerned about the threat of open source library systems, not so much to the libraries that were their customers, but to their own business model. And they were being forced into actually changing their business model to provide more support and to start providing enhancements to compete with the open source library system. So they wanted to try and stamp that out as much as possible. It also raised awareness in the library community in general of the availability of open source library systems and their actual viability as an alternative.
So they got exactly the opposite effect from what they wanted, which is that they were trying to stomp these things out. But problem is, you know, to stomp something out, you got to point out the fact that it's there. And that was the big issue there.
Exactly. And so there were some valid criticisms. They talked about, the state of testing or quality assurance in the project. That said, nobody actually can step behind the walls of a proprietary vendor and ascertain that their quality processes are any good. At least our processes are out in the open and can be enhanced fairly easily if people want to contribute further to them. You would expect that stepping into this territory, someone might have read, say, the Halloween documents and the reaction to the Halloween documents that occurred back when Microsoft released similar material that didn't seem to slow down the adoption of Linux as a server platform. And probably increased its adoption. So,
yeah, actually, I mean, like I said, you start slapping on something, and people go, "Oh, what are you slapping on there?" Well, let's take a look at that. So, kind of an interesting way to go about that. You mentioned earlier that you have a pretty big user community and a pretty active mailing list. Thing. Yeah, well, how many libraries do you think are using Evergreen at this point? And how big is the set of committers to people that can actually change the software?
Okay, so set of committers we have listed on the wiki. I believe we're at around 15 committers or so. Okay. So a small core of committers. I think at present the only committer outside of Equinox who is actively committing. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 11 core committers at the moment. Sorry, 15 is a bit of an overreach. In terms of the number of libraries, don't have a really great handle on that because, of course, anybody willing or is free to download and run it. And we do try and provide a list of the libraries that run Evergreen on our wiki, and we invite those libraries to come on board. And there's always a difference between a library system that's actually a consortium of libraries and, you know, one-off libraries. A place like Georgia Pines has 200 libraries in a single consortial instance of Evergreen running, Mike just popped in, via chat saying, 500 to 600 libraries with 50 or 60 installations at this point. So cool. In some ways we're still relatively small, still have a long ways to grow. We're very quickly growing and moving into some very large scale large scale libraries.
Mm-hmm. And what are you looking for in terms of people to contribute to the project? What kind of skills do people need? Obviously Perl and maybe some C, but what, and obviously motivated by probably working in a library. So what are you looking for in terms of people to contribute to your project?
Well, as I mentioned, testing and QA is probably one of the fronts where we could get a really quick bang for our buck. For somebody who's got familiarity with testing frameworks, particularly with Perl and C, that would be fabulous to set something up that would be easy to extend. We have some ad hoc tests that we run at the moment, but it's pretty... we'd like to get a continuous integration environment built and running so that we could save ourselves some time and pain later on down the road. Documentation, we have an active documentation interest group. They've started putting together a manual for Evergreen, which is great, but always more writers are always good. I was a technical writer in a previous life, and I love them greatly. We could use a better internationalization maintainer than myself. I originally got interested in Evergreen because our library is a bilingual university, and our product that we were using before for a library system sort of had internationalization grafted onto the side, and it was pretty clear there were a lot of holes. So it was nice to be able to tackle Evergreen and start making it internationalized from the inside out. But there's a lot further to go with that, and I've been focusing on a lot more functional pieces recently. Porting and packaging would be fabulous. As I said, we run on Linux primarily. There have been some people who have taken a stab at providing more BSD support, but we don't have a reported success of it running there yet. So I'd love to have somebody from the BSD communities step up and help us out with that. I hear that BSD is the best place to run Postgres, so I'd love to see how that works out. Translations, of course, always good. Other skills, if you're a web designer, just having CSS and JavaScript skills could go a long way towards improving some of those rough edges that I was talking about before, too.
Very cool. Very cool. So it sounds like a little bit of the usual sort of litany for open source projects. That sounds great. And you had to translate it to Canadian, obviously, right? Add a little A on the end of things. Never mind. I'm gonna hear from all my Canadian audience now. But
totally. Well, yeah.
One last question is, Mike's not here. I was going to ask him. I'll ask you instead. I'll ask both of you, but he's not here again. Emacs or VI?
I can answer for both Mike and I. We're both Vim users. We love Vim. Yeah, there have recently been a few new committers and contributors who are Emacs users, so we're spreading out the love a little bit. But Okay. Yeah, VI hands down for most of the original developers on the project.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I really appreciate you coming by today, and I'm sorry we keep losing Mike in and out a bit there. Apparently, wherever he was at, slightly flaky. Oh, there he is. Hello, Mike. He's back. Say hi while you can. Say hello and goodbye.
Hello and goodbye. Yeah, if I send more than 37K, it's going to drop. So.
So any last words to add to our conversation, Mike?
I just want to thank you guys for having us on. It's been a lot of fun, and I think I've already dropped again.
Oh, you're there. That's great. And any last words, Dan? Dan, the guest, not Dan, the co-host.
Oh, I have to send a shout-out to Linux Outlaws. Great podcast. Really entertaining and enjoyable. So thanks, Dane Lynch, for that. And thank you for having us on Floss Weekly. It's really been a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Appreciate you coming on talking about this. I know there's a lot of people now that know about this that wouldn't have otherwise. And I'm hoping my local library uses it. I may actually go into my local library again. Let's just to see how well that works out. It'll be great. Well, I hear they have DVDs, so that's good. I might stop by for a DVD. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
So, great show. Great show. Thank you, guys. Dan, the other Dan, Mr. Lynch.
I need to
specify the last name. What? I love that librarians love Perl. This is great. I'm sitting here like doing a little dance. Like, oh yeah, Perl. Yay, Perl's good for this stuff. That was good, huh?
Yeah, they do. I never realized librarians were so so obsessed with Perl. Quite clearly, so maybe you should get in there and offer them some training, Randall. You could be missing out.
Yeah, good idea. Good idea. So speaking of. Speaking of upcoming guests, oh wait, I don't really know who's speaking of that, but hey, I'll do that anyway. I did a little bit of work between last week and this week, and I've got a bunch of new people scheduled for September and October. So as I've been saying for a while now, we've got the next week coming up, we've got Thomas Cherry Holmes, who's going to talk to us about Linux MCE, which is a home automation system, home automation, home alarm system, home media player system. And we have a special co-host, Scott Wilkinson, is going to come in from the Twitch show Home Theater something or other. I forget the actual name of the show, but I should have that down by next week. We've also got, just added to the schedule, a whole bunch of new names. We've got Walter Bender of Sugar Labs. Sugar Labs is the software that's being used on the OLPC, the one laptop per child small thing, and it's cooperative by default. And so he's going to talk a lot about how that all works. It's all Python, unfortunately, but that's okay. I'll let him on anyway. He has to indent his show properly. We just added also Patrick Ballou, I'm probably mispronouncing this, talking to us about Webcam Studio, which is a way of mixing multiple video sources together to make a single virtual webcam to send out on things like Skype and stuff. That'll be a lot of fun. Only runs on Linux, though, so I won't get to play with it before then. Karsten Dominik's joining us, talking about Emacs Org Mode, which is a it's got everything in it. I mean, Emacs already has great things in it. I know he's using Emacs to the VI. Because it's got everything in it. It's got like a spreadsheet built in that can do calculations. It's got like folding outline mode, and it's got to-do lists and everything all inside this one mode inside Emacs. We also have Ross Boucher talking to us about Cappuccino, which is the web development framework that's apparently very popular. And Darren Schreiber joins us in a few weeks talking about the 2600 Hertz project, which is a end-to-end telephony installation. So all the aspects related to open-source telephony, which will be a lot of fun to talk to you about that, because we've had people like Asterisk and recently this other show that we had on Ascosia was also on recently. But we'll talk to him about end-to-end telephony. Lots of good people. A lot of other people coming up in the short list. If you go to twit.tv/floss, you can find the spreadsheet linked from there of all the people I'm actually working on to try to get into the show. And if you have a friend of yours that has a project, an open source project that wants to be on this show, just have them email me. My email address is listed there as well. Let's see. What else have I got here? Dan, where are you going to be coming up soon? Where do we find you?
Well, obviously, you can find us at linuxoutlaws.com if you want to check out Linux Outlaws podcast. That's usually live every Monday night. That's in the UK, I should say. So that's 7 o'clock UK time, which I believe is about 2 o'clock East Coast. And about 11 o'clock in the morning on the West Coast in the US. And we're going to have lots of stuff on there. And at the moment, I'm actually having a play with Android for the first time. I realize the rest of the world's been on Android for a while now, but ever the cutting edge guy that I am, I've just got myself a HTC a Desire phone. So I'm interested in finding out more about that and how hackable it is and stuff like that. And I'll be writing about that on my blog and other places. So you can go to danlynch.org if you want to find out more about that.
And if you follow me on Twitter, you'll also see, especially if in the last couple of days, you've seen all my new guests that I keep assigning to this show. But you'll also see in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be down at DragonCon, which is my one indulgence conference every year. I go to a lot of conferences because I have to, because it's part of my job. But DragonCon is like 30,000 people all dressed up in sci-fi outfits and studying pretty much everything under the sun in terms of fantasy and science fiction and so on. I'll be down there speaking actually on the Hacker 101 and 201 panels. If you follow me on Twitter, that's twitter.com/Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. You'll see when I'm actually going to be hooking up actually with Tom Merritt and Veronica Belmont going to be down there. So we're going to be trying to hook up with them. And one last plug I've got to make for myself here. I'm so happy. I'm so proud about this. I am now a narrator for science fiction short stories. StarshipSofa.com has been around for a number of years. I really encourage you to go check them out. I've been listening to them for a long time, and I wrote them a few months back, and I said, how do you get to be a narrator for this stuff? How do you get to actually like contribute? And immediately the head guy writes back, and he goes, oh, yeah, here, take the story. I listened to Floss Weekly. So I was going, yay, all right. So somebody was already a fan of mine. And I read my first piece, I'm very proud to say, is actually this month's featured piece. And it just came out in episode 150, which is the show we're having right now. Starship Self is actually the first podcast that's been nominated for a Hugo Award, which is the big science fiction awards. Mostly it was for fanzines and stuff. So it's actually great that they're finally getting off in the paper world and getting into the electronic world by nominating Starship Sofa. So check out my my reading of Starship on StarshipSofa.com, my reading of Personal Jesus. It's great. It's about iPods that speak to God. It's really cool. They call them God pods. Really great thing. And I also that's a 20-minute piece. I also did a 50-minute piece coming up in probably another 3 or 4 weeks called Jumpers. Really great story. So I'm having fun narrating. It's one more hat for me to wear. And, I just like doing this stuff. So it's all good. Any last words, Dan?
No, it sounds cool. I like the almost open source connection you've got there with the fact that you managed to get in touch with them and, you know, almost submit a patch, if you like, and get onto the show. That's really great.
I did. You know, it's great because I wanted to say, you know, I know Leo is narrated for Audible, but I wanted to I wanted to do something to contribute back. And I have a voice and I have a really nice Blue Yeti mic at home. So I wanted to take advantage of that. And he said, yeah, come on, Doug Smith said, yeah, come on. We'll we'll let you talk. So apparently I get to talk into a mic for yet another show.
Cool. Yeah, well, thanks to everyone for joining us. That's my last words, I think.
Okay, and my usual last words are, we'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.